time now to go to Sunday school with the professor. Giants third base coach Ron Wotus with Marty Lorenz.
Oh, I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper.
On your home of Giants baseball.
Good answer. Like the way you think.
KNBR 680, the sports leader.
I love it. I'll tell you, you got the best introduction in baseball.
Well, it brings me back to school, which I actually did at one point. You know, I signed out of high school, right, Marty?
And yeah.
I never went to college, so one winter, since I was managing in the minor leagues and didn't see my wife very much, we decided to take an art history class together over at DVC College in the fall. And we did that, so I kind of relate to the back to school in Rodney Dangerfield where that all is from, because I did it myself.
Yeah, did you take a test, and did you, you know, go the whole course, the whole thing?
I took a test. Lori sat real close to me so I could look at her paper a little bit. No, I passed. I'll say I passed the one course. And you know what, honestly, it gave me a foundation for art history, and we traveled and gone places. We look at art a lot. And I've enjoyed it. I was really appreciative of taking that class.
Yeah, it's a tough one for draftees in baseball. Now, if you get drafted in the first five rounds, you're probably guaranteed $800,000 minimum, whatever. But for the guys down the road, it is a choice. Do you go to college, or do you take the money and start a pro career as 18-year-olds, going, never doing your laundry before and all that?
Right. Well, that's the big decision, and it's made easy if you're a high pick, as you said. If you're not, everybody's different. I don't know what the kids do today, but I know I struggled with that decision a little bit. I wasn't a high pick, 16th round, and I got a little bit of money and a breakfast. But, you know, I decided to go into pro ball. I don't know if I told this on the air here or not. I've told a few people. You know, I was going to go to Clemson, go to college, and I wasn't sure what to do. I was drafted, and, you know, I leaned on my dad. I said, you know, what do you think? And he said, well, you're just going to college to play baseball. If you love baseball and that's what you want to do, go for it. And I did.
Yeah, but what city did you go to first? You know, I'm bringing up this. Look, Joey Bart is killing the Northwest
right.
League, and things are happening up there. A young man got hit in the head, Santos. I saw that, right? Actually, Allie, what happened up there?
I missed it.
I just know he got hit in the head by a 105-mile-an-hour line drive comebacker and got taken off on a stretcher, went to the hospital. I'm not sure the follow-up, though.
Yeah, Allie, maybe you can look it up this morning. But, yeah, it happened up there. But I guess my point to you is, you know, as an 18-year-old, you're going to it. What city did you go to? What was the adjustment? Did you know how to do your laundry? Did you know how to write a check?
Well, we went to Bradenton, Florida. It was rookie ball with the San Francisco Giants. I mean, excuse me, the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah.
Excuse me. In the rookie balls in the summer. As soon as the summer draft's over, you go play. And you know, I thought I was going to be tremendous. You know, here I was in Connecticut, hadn't traveled too much. I was going to go to Florida, right? I was going to have a great time in Florida. I was going to see beaches and the whole thing. I land in the airport and there's no beaches. I'm driving 5 minutes to get to Pirate City, beautiful Pirate City. They actually housed us there, which made it easier in a lot of ways, except for the fact that you had three other roommates and double bunk beds in a motel size room. But those are the things you deal with. And, you know, I was out of high school. It would have been a lot more difficult for college guys to deal with that in those living conditions. Of course, a lot of them are probably used to having roommates. So it was different. You lived at Pirate City. They fed you at Pirate City. The fields were right there, and you tried to break out of there on the weekends and at night just to get some sanity.
What were you doing? I mean, I've been in Bradenton. I mean, Mike Quadi lives there.
Yeah.
Donnie Robinson, I met him there. Keeson, when he was alive, he lived there. Tony Bartirome.
Yes, Tony.
I met him. Steve Ridzik. You know, the old ballplayers I got to meet.
Right.
But what was Bradenton like for you?
Well, Bradenton was, you know, great at the time. Look, it's a beautiful area. You know, we'd always slide over to Sarasota as well, which has beautiful beaches and shopping and the whole thing. Bradenton Beach, Anna Marie Island. You know, as I progressed in my career and I didn't have to stay at Pirate City, you know, you can live off when you're a major league player. And we lived down at the beach. Just lived with Lee Tunnell and his wife and Lori one spring. So it is a beautiful area. And that was a lot nicer. But those are the things you deal with when you first draft it. And it's the right way to do it for me. I mean, you're inducted into how things introduced and how you do things in pro ball. And it's all business. It's all baseball. And it was great. I enjoyed it.
You ever go to one of those, like the Alaska League or the Cape Cod League or anything like that? Did you ever have that experience?
No. That was for college players, you know, guys out of college. I was drafted out of high school. So, you know, I played the seasons and then that was it.
Yeah, in the old days, you would play under an assumed name, and they would have leagues all around, and you get paid $50 or $100, and instead of calling you Ron Wotus, they would call you Marty Lurie, you know. So, you know, honestly, and then you'd go back and be a high school player and all that, but I guess all that, you know, that semi-pro they used to call it.
Yeah, no, I wasn't familiar with that. You know, we played American Legion ball, I think I mentioned before, in the summertime, and that was the extent of it, yeah.
Well, something came up on our podcast this week. We do this thing, you know, I sent you a couple of them on text.
Yes.
Mid-inning relief. It's really kind of fun. It's about 40 minutes of Ali and Carmen and me talking. We have guests every once in a while. Dave Fleming was on.
Right.
So one of the questions came up, and it sort of was, in baseball, we like to get topics. In the Cardinal clubhouse, they had some bullying issues with Bud Norris and Hicks and things like Jordan Hicks. And it came up on the podcast. Because you guys have, at the end of the season, they dress up the rookies.
Right.
And, you know, you got to carry the candy bag and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Now, you go back a ways in baseball. Things have changed. But is this stuff still going on? And what do you think about it? And in the world today, the society we have?
Well, it goes on in a different place, different level. I mean, you know, it's more in fun. The other thing that goes along with that is the kangaroo court. You know, holding people accountable for, you know, their performances on the field, and then it diverts off into, you know, you embarrass the team by what you wore the other day, or it gets, you know, it goes off on tangents. But I think in any workplace in life, you got to find your way, and you have to fit in, and you have to fend for yourself. And I think it's all part of it to a certain degree. You know, not the bullying and the hazing.
The
hazing is out of line today. I mean, they take it too far. You know, certainly saw a lot of that with rookies in the three-man lift, where you say you get three guys on the ground, you take the rookie or the young guy, you set him up saying, oh, you know, we can lift you off the ground, and you hold the guy down, and everybody comes in with anything they can put their hands on, the mustard, the mayonnaise, the water, the beer, whatever, and they just kill the guy with it. They put it all over him, and all these things are done in fun, but you can't cross the line. So I think you got to be careful today. But I do think that this stuff has always gone on. Whether you're the rookie, you know, you have to find your place. You have to earn the respect of the people that are there and fit in with the team. So it's a common thing.
Yeah, I guess the world is changing, though. And I think in the Cardinal clubhouse, it became an issue.
Right.
And I guess the other thing we talked about, at the end of the season, they dress everybody up.
Right.
And whether that is, you know, funny or does it cross the line or not.
Yeah, you know, we do it. And everybody seems to be okay with it today. I know if I never had to dress up. And
that.
If I did, I would have had a problem with it. That's for sure.
And what about hazing for you back then? What did they, you know, the Pirates, come on, this was a veteran team, a former World Series team, championship team.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't good enough. They didn't pay much attention to me. They didn't haze me. So, and I was happy with that. So that was no problem for me.
All right. Yesterday, an amazing day at the ballpark for the fans. And just, you know, the thing went on for an hour and a half. And, you know, the Giants understand how to do it to connect the generations of baseball. You were part of it yesterday. What did you think?
Yeah. Well, I listened to you a little bit on a drive home yesterday, and I thought you had some great things to say about it. I mean, so much has been said already, but I agree with you know, most of the things that I've been hearing on the radio and with. It was obviously well done. It was great to see, you know, Barry have his day. It's undeniable what he accomplished in this city. You look at the back of his baseball card, and he deserves that. And to be there with the other Hall of Famers, you know, it was said yesterday he helped build this stadium. You know, and he deserved that day, and I thought it was well done, as always, and it was great to see a lot of the people that showed up there yesterday and listen to them talk, you know, Leland and Dusty and even Gagne. That was a nice twist to have him come in there.
How about that at bat with Gagne? You were there.
Yeah.
What about that at bat?
Yeah. Well, when he pulled that one foul, a home run, you just, you know, it was like, wow. And, you know, they showed it on the video board yesterday, and in real life, it was ratcheted up more than that. You know, it was it was live in the moment, and it was a big moment. And, yeah, I thought that was nice to see and have him come out here and talk about it as well, added another element to the celebration.
Yeah, it made me think about a couple of things and something else we talked about on the podcast, and that is not that we have to get into tampering in any way, but Kershaw, he may opt out. And should the Giants go after Kershaw, bring Kershaw here as a Giant and all that kind of stuff. So without dealing with names, Hershiser came here and was a Giant.
Right.
So I guess it happens in baseball where, you know, Gagne can come back and he didn't get booed that loudly.
I mean,
it kind of sort of happened. What do you think about players who have been big rivals coming back like that into a new clubhouse? How does that happen?
Well, as you said, the world is changing a little bit, and you know, years ago, obviously, you know, players didn't change team as frequently as they do today. Now, this is a different scenario. A guy that's been a lifelong player on one team, but you know, it's all about winning baseball games. And I guarantee you, you might hate the guy, but if he comes over and plays on your team and he performs, you're gonna love him. And that's the bottom line. I mean, you want to win. And if he's the best fit and you can get him and he's a part of making you better, you definitely have to be open to that.
How about Randy Johnson when he came over?
Yeah, Randy Johnson. There's been guys that have done it. You know, as I said, if he performs well for you, your short memory you'll go from hating him to loving him.
Yeah, that's baseball. All right, the third base coach is with us. He had a very eventful week this week. You know, number one, you're starting to get a little nimble down there and starting to catch some of these ground balls in the coach's box. What's going on with you? You're not letting them go. You're starting to move a little bit.
Well, I'm picking my spots. If you notice, there's a couple balls hit the last 2 days where it hit a little too firm that I kind of backed away and didn't bend over. I didn't want to embarrass myself any more than I already have on a couple of them. But when they come down there, sometimes, you know, the playing days come back and you just want to grab it. You want to grab the ball. And so I've had a major blunder earlier this past week. I missed a ball in Arizona that was pretty embarrassing. So thanks for bringing it up.
Well, look, it's part of the game. You know, you're out there. But now you got hazed a little bit by Chase Darno.
Yeah, Chase.
very talented kid.
Very talented. He loves music. He makes music videos. There's a lot of people out there probably know, and you know, I've been working with him quite a bit, and he actually told me, "Oh, I'm going to make a video with you," and he was trying to find a song, a walk-up song for me. And there's a couple rap songs out there that say "Whoa," you know, the beat goes on "Whoa," and I don't remember the artist who it is, but so he did. He put a little thing together, but he found a song that he liked, but he only took one video clip. He didn't do a, you know, a montage of great plays or anything like that, but it was the ground ball that was hit slow, hit me square in the hands, and then trickled between my legs in Arizona. So pretty comical. He played it during batting practice, so everybody got a good look at it.
That's fun. That's, you know.
Well, he's continuing to do that. I'm sure he's gonna get a couple other guys before this season's over, I'm sure.
I love it. All right, let's talk a little. Let's go to school with the professor on this Sunday morning. Dwayne Kuiper said, you know, he never learns anything from us, so we got to come up with something good here.
Yeah, we have to be good this morning.
Right? If you're listening, Dwayne, we're going to give you one here. Second base. And Dwayne was a second baseman. One of the plays that I see a lot, and you guys work so much before the game, and we know that, and you know, one of the things you and I have learned over all these years is how much work you do before the game. There's a play at second base where the second baseman turns a double play, but the ball's hit the second baseman, and he, like, pivots on both feet to, like, almost jumps to get the ball to second, to the shortstop. How do you make that play? Because you always talked about, look at the guy's feet. And this isn't the shovel. This is, you know, the ball, and almost like he jumps like an ice skater in a way. How does that work?
Yeah, well, Dwayne will tell you, and if he's listening, he can call in and, and tell us how he did it, because, you know, there's a couple ways to do it. And one, I think the jump turn, I think, is more prevalent today. We call that the jump turn. The other way most second basemen get it, they catch it, you know, and they get a wide base. They catch it with their right foot back a little bit, and then they just pivot and turn and throw. Like Robbie Thompson used to do it like that. And that's the way I was taught as well. And everybody felt that was the quickest way to do it. But over the years, or guys that aren't efficient at that, and guys that, you know, for me, that don't necessarily have great hands or feet, sometimes it's better for them to fight to get to the ball. And then once they catch it, jump, turn, and throw.
Okay.
So there's two different ways to do it that way. Because when you set up and you just pivot, you have to set up a little earlier and the ball can take a bad hop. So the other way, you keep your feet going, you fight to catch the ball. Then once you do, you give that jump, turn like Joe Panik does.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking about, Panik.
That's how he does it. And he positions himself a little bit open as if he was going to catch the ball. But he uses a little jump, turn. And it's a player's preference in which way they're better at it. But I honestly find that the jump turn is more consistent than the pivot for a lot of guys. And most of our guys have been doing it that way.
And what about the throw, though? I mean, as you're jumping, you've got to line the throw up for the shortstop at that point.
Well, it's easier as well because you're resetting your balance. When you pivot and throw, it's all arm. When you jump turn, you can jump and get your whole body into the throw. So I think there's some benefits to it. You know, whether it's a little bit slower or not, you'd have to put the watch on the guy and see him do it both ways. But I do believe it's more consistent of making the play.
Yeah, interesting, because you did bring up Panik, and that's in my mind. That's the image I have.
Yeah, a lot of guys did. I remember Ray Durham, who was here this weekend. Great to see him again as well. And hopefully we'll get to play some golf this winter. He's living up north, you know, near Tahoe. But when he came over from Chicago, he used to be a pivot guy. And we talked about it, and we worked on both ways. And he became a jump turn guy. You know, he was low to the ground, had quick feet, and he was very good at it. And so most of our guys have done it now. It's a much more common way to do it.
That's something to look at. Well, yeah. I'm going to watch. Panik absolutely came to my mind on that one.
Yeah.
And how because he does it beautifully.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really almost poetic the way he does it. The other thing I noticed, again, watching all these games, ground ball hit the first. And, of course, the pitcher's got a break to get over there, and you guys work on that every day. It's spring training, you know, so it should be muscle memory. But the throw from the first baseman to the pitcher, I always thought underhand,
right.
Underhand. I'm not seeing as many underhand throws. I'm seeing overhand throws and weird throws,
yeah.
And I'm seeing the pitcher looking for the bag
right.
Because the throw is up and all over the place. So
right.
How do you teach that?
Yeah. Well, you know, you like to make it as routine as you can. And if you do get the ball at first and you can take it yourself, that's the number one thing. You don't want to flip it to the pitcher. You see, that's what, you know, drives you nuts watching the game. You see a first baseman catch the ball and all he has to do is take five steps and touch the base. But instead, he flips his little ball to the pitcher. And we've all seen those drop because, as you said, sometimes they're trying to catch the ball, look for the bag, and it just happens. You know, there's a lot of tosses, a lot of games, and you see it happen. So ideally, once you do catch the ball at first, you want to get your feet going and you start running towards the base as if you're going to take it yourself. You know what I mean? Try to take it yourself, and then as you determine you can't get there, then you can give the underhand toss and lead the pitcher. You want a higher throw above his waist. You don't want to handcuff him or low. You do want it up. It's easier to catch the ball. So that's how you want to try to do it, is catch the ball, get your feet going, and then give him the underhand toss where he can handle it easily, and then he can catch the ball and touch the base. But what happens is when the ball's hit towards second base, deep in the hole, the infielders instinctively, the first baseman knows that I can't take it myself, and there's no reason to start running and then make a long underhand toss. So they set up, and that's the ball you throw to him as if you're a quarterback and lead him and try to give him a nice firm throw. And you know, that's a little touch. It's a touch throw, you know, so it's not worked on a whole lot in batting practice. They do it in the spring, as you said, a million times. But our guys once in a while will do it just to work on that touch throw once in a while.
Yeah, so I see the overhand throw more and more, and I'm trying to think, is it the shift?
Yeah,
you know,
I think you're right.
Right? First baseman is further off the bag.
Yes, yeah, you're exactly right. That's probably why you see it. You know, years ago, what first baseman played towards second base like that? So they're so far off, they're getting those balls in the hole.
Right.
You know, it's tough to hit the ground balls through the infield, as you talked about a couple weeks ago with all these shifts. But just the positioning of the first baseman has changed quite a bit over the years.
We still see a lot of arguments about the shifts. Baseball talks about it all the time. And some people say, well, you have to have your feet in on the dirt. You don't care where you put everybody, but your feet have to be on the dirt. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm not buying it. I mean, okay. If, you know, as long as I've ever played the game, whether it was wiffle ball in your backyard or high school or Legion or professional baseball, you're going to read the swing and play where you think the guy's going to hit the ball. And the other thing is, as a second baseman, there's been a lot of second basemen over the years. When you have a big, slow guy up, pull hitter, you're going to play on the grass. You may not have been in a big shift and out there, you know, 30, 40 feet, but you're going to play as deep as you possibly can to get more range. So that's just not a shift thing, playing on the grass. You saw in Albert Pujols in the American League, a lot of the shortstops are playing him in the left field grass.
Well, the famous Ernie Lombardi, one of those names that you love. He was a catcher, He led the league in National League in hitting twice, but he was so slow that the shortstop played in left field.
Right,
and he still led the league in hitting.
He did? Wow.
Still led Ernie the Great, Ernie Lombardi.
That's a good hitter. Well, you know, I just think you can't take away the instinct of the player, you know. So I'm not buying that. I think they should be able to play where they want to play.
All right. It's interesting. I was thinking about this. You were a bench coach. You were that for Dusty, and he was here. Felipe couldn't make it. And, of course, with Bruce Bochy, which we've talked about over the years. But what was it like being a bench coach for Dusty Baker? What was that like for him, running a game with him?
Well, you know, all of them, it was a treat to work
right?
for him. All different, you know. But Dusty was great because he talked a lot. He communicated a lot. He was always in conversation before something happened, you know, so you can give it some thought. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that, opposed to, you know, just getting a question, you know, and you have 5 seconds to give an answer. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. And, you know, great spirit, obviously, great manager, and learned a lot being around him. But, no, he would communicate a lot, and I really appreciated that.
And people brought him food all the time.
Yeah, well, you talk about the fruit.
I brought you a nice peach today.
Yeah, you did give me a nice peach. Thanks. Dusty would love this peach, especially on the Sunday day game. He'd have his fruit lined up there. And I'm sure if he's listening, Dusty's probably having some fruit right now. But he did enjoy a little fruit on the day, a nice sunny day game.
Yeah, he was the best. When I would go in his office, when he was with the Cubs, they would bring in shrimp and crab. And, I mean, really, the guy was like he was running a restaurant
right
in there.
You would think he'd have been eating steak during the game with that toothpick he had in his mouth. But I guess he needed the toothpick for fruit. No, but I know there's stories behind the toothpicks as well. But, he'd love this peach right here, Marty. Yeah.
All right, how about Felipe? Now, Felipe was the philosopher all the time. You know, he had all the sayings, which you still use. You still use the sayings.
Right.
What was he like?
He, he as well was a very, very aggressive manager on defense. Okay. He loved to control the running game and not have anybody steal on you. I mean, he had Louis Pujols, his good friend, was with him here for a few years as well. And they really enjoyed shutting down the running game and running bunt plays. I think when Felipe was here, he loved the wheel play. He loved keeping the guy off third when it was first and second and trying to, limit the bunt to get over. So very aggressive. Obviously loved listening to him, you know, tell his stories, especially after the game. He would come in with the wine and you know, hold court in the coach's room and enjoyed listening to him replay the game and talk about his beliefs during the game. You know, he obviously communicated as a manager as well, but you know, he pretty much let me do my thing, the areas that I had control of, and you know, he did his thing with the running game.
Yeah, and he always would say, as soon as somebody got a hit, no hitter. Is that one of his things?
Yeah. No, he would scream out. He'd scream out, there goes your no. Love to hear him that. You know, they all have their little quirks and things like that, but he'd do that all the time. There goes your no. Yeah.
He was a great player. I want to tell you, Willie Mays says it, that Philippe Alou was maybe, as Willie says, the second best outfielder on the team. But Felipe was you don't remember him at all as a player.
Player, but I've heard the stories, and I've heard people say those same things about how good of a ball player he is. And I know he was a great manager and a great mind and developer of talent, you know, evaluator, seeing players, and he's, you know, still doing that for us today.
Yeah. Gary Hughes is with us. Yeah. Gary, of course, one of the great scouts in baseball. You know Gary Hughes.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we go way back.
Yeah. Yeah, Gary was the one who drafted Rex Hudler.
Yeah, Rex.
My claim to fame.
Right, Rex Hudler.
Well, he's drafted a lot more guys than Rex Hudler.
And John
Rex
Elway.
And John Elway.
Yeah, right. Gary.
John Lynch.
Come on over, Gary, for a second. Go, Carmen, let Gary hit your mic for a second there. Yeah, go ahead. Gary Hughes, a legend of the Bay Area.
In his own mind.
Yeah, pull up that mic a little bit for you. Go ahead, Carmen. Get
there you go.
There you go.
Good.
All right. So,
can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Your favorite, I brought up John Elway, Rex Hudler, but you were a scouting director for so many years. Who were some of the people that you enjoyed drafting?
Somebody asked me this years back, and I gave him five names that I drafted as a scouting director. And 3 years later, I realized what I'd said. Here are the five guys, if I can remember now. Marquise Grissom, Delino DeShields, Cliff Floyd, Charles Johnson, Rondale White.
Not bad.
Pretty darn good.
See any similarities there?
Yeah.
Every one of them an African-American, almost every one of them out of high school. Charles, I had to draft twice to get him signed, but first round out of high school and first round out of college.
Yeah, amazing. But you were, I'm glad you walked by and we invited you in. Talk about Felipe as a manager. And Gary, you, of course, the Expo years you were there, of course. What about Felipe?
Well, the one thing I'll say to start out is I kept telling David for a while, Dombrowski, I said, this guy's a big league manager. Felipe managed in Denver, Colorado, AAA for us for the Expos the year before I got there. The next year, he said, "No, I want to manage an A-ball." So he left AAA to come back to A-ball. I think his main reason was the Lake Worth Pier. He liked fishing on the Lake Worth Pier,
right?
And but he was brilliant. And I mean, he speaks in parables. I mean, you'd be a year later, or sometimes it'd be 2 weeks later, whatever. Oh, that's what he meant, you know, and just unbelievable. He talked about 200 inning pitchers, and he says, all these people tell me about 200 good. He says, I want 200 good innings.
That's right.
Yeah, a very special guy, right, Will?
No question. You know what? I feel so fortunate to have worked with him and been around him, and he's still with us. And he's probably seen more baseball games than any human alive. Not just managing, but going to the Dominican in winter ball, and he loves the game, and he is the game. Yeah, what a great man.
And he was a major advocate for the Latin Bill of Rights in baseball. He was the Jackie Robinson of for Latin America. He was the first native Dominican from the island to come into Major League Baseball. Ozzie Virgil was the first, but he lived in New York. He was Dominican, but Felipe came from the island. He was the first one. And when in 1959, when Willie McCovey was brought up, you had to get someone brought up before August 1st, so it's July 30th, right? McCovey came up for his debut.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they brought McCovey up. They had to get rid of somebody, and it was Felipe. And he was hitting like 320. And Felipe said, I'm not going. And this is really 1959, where you didn't do stuff like that. And he said, I'm done, and he went home to the Dominican. Well, the Giants got so upset, Horace Stone, and maybe bring him back. So they brought him back, and they retired Hank Sauer. And that's when Hank Sauer became a coach.
No, I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and Felipe wouldn't. You know, he said, I'm playing. But he had that way about him, very confident, right, Walt?
Yes, confident, never second-guessed himself, you know. I mean, he makes his decision, and he lives with it, and he believes in it. That is a great story, and that sums him up. You know, very confident. He knows what he wants to do, and he does it, and he doesn't think twice about it.
How did he handle Barry Bonds? Because Barry Bonds obviously was a special case, and here's Felipe, the hard-nosed manager.
Yeah.
You know, how did he handle Barry Bonds?
He handled them like he did all veteran players. He gave them the respect that they deserved, and he handled them appropriately. I mean, you're not as good as Felipe Alou if you don't know how to handle different personalities and individuals, and he did. He handled Barry fine. He gave him the respect that you know, he deserved for who he was, and managed him accordingly.
Boy, very good. Go ahead, Gary.
When he managed in A-ball, he would tell the umpires not to start the game because it's going to rain in 20 minutes. and they'd start the game, and it'd rain, and he'd have to start another pitcher. And he's, I told you.
That's great, Gary, you bring that up, because he was always on the weather here.
Oh, yeah.
Which is hard to predict in San Francisco, but on the road, he would know the weather. By the wind would pick up, and he would know. That's great.
You know, he mentioned the wine and everything, and I would, after on Saturdays, I would go across the street, and Felipe would barbecue for us. Sometimes Moises, sometimes Gene Glenn would be there, you know, and it was wonderful times.
Amazing guy, Felipe. It's good to talk about him. I like talking about him. But the last thing for both of you guys, he changed pitchers quite frequently. That was something he did. What about that, Gary?
His brother, Jesus, and that's another story. When Jesus Alou came to San Francisco, nobody knew what to call him. With Jesus came, and now he's Jay half the time. But he says, my brother changes pitchers like he changes wives.
Well, you were there for that, being the pitch coach. He changed pitchers a lot.
Well, he's proactive, not reactive, and it goes to his confidence and his knowledge in the game. He was very aggressive, as I said, on defense. So that was part of it, too. He loved controlling the running game. He loved not letting people advance the guy to third on a bunt. And he was going to do everything in his power to win that game. And if he felt the other pitcher was a better matchup, he was going to make the move. He definitely made a lot of pitching changes.
You know, of course, the professor, Gary Hughes, is with us, legendary scout. One thing I wanted to bring up this morning, and it's throws from the outfield, I realize Duggar's learning, or young people learn in the outfield, but there's a first and second, and there's a deep fly to center. The guy in second is going to tag and go to third. There's no chance. Throw the ball to second base. Keep the double play in order.
Yeah.
Now, I'm thinking Felipe. I mean, you know, he's such a fundamental guy.
Sure.
You see that all the time. How do you bring that home to outfielders? Don't waste your arm like that.
Well, they should know, you know, the situation. And the infielder helps, too. I mean, you got to put some responsibility on the shortstop and the second baseman, depending on where the ball is, because they should, when they know there's no play at third, they should go out and line up the second and help, you know, give that outfielder the visual and even yell, hey, second, second. So it works both ways. And that's, you know, part of playing the game and gaining experience and trying to do things the right way.
I'll caution you, make a cautionary statement. Don't try this at home. This is just a scout talking. I firmly believe that at the beginning of the year, if you hit a ball to the outfield, if the outfield just picked the ball up every time for the entire year and threw it to second base, he'd be ahead of the game.
Yeah, funny. Yeah, because it's a little part. Well, when I talk about it, the little parts of the game, you know, to keep the double play in order.
Yeah, that's what cutoffs and relays are designed to do, is to keep the double play in order and stop the run from scoring. Those two things are what you want to accomplish. And when you start airmailing on the ball and throwing to a base when you have no shot. But, you know, that's the player trying to make a play. A lot of times, you know, you can't fault them sometimes, but you got to hit the cutoff man. That's why I say the relay man or the cutoff man has to be part of the equation, too, that he has to line up in the right spot to give the outfielder sometimes the option to just not quit on the play, but to throw it to the relay man or cutoff man.
going back to another outfielder from Sarah High School, namely me, Jim Fregosi was a shortstop, and all I had to do was get the ball to Fregosi because he could throw. He had such a strong arm, and that's all I knew. Just get the ball to him. He'll do what's right. Keep it away from the other guy.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Just get it to the shortstop and don't worry about it.
Yeah.
After that, very good. All right, we'll take a break. Ron Wotus with us, Gary Hughes, a legendary Sky. Gary, thank you for stopping by. Well, I want to talk a little bit about Tony Sipp when we come back. Tony Sipp and Woe got into it this week in an interesting way. So we'll do that when we come back right after this.